Okay, well, welcome to the sixth edition of the DMSC Masterclass. This monthly class is for DMSC students and faculty and those who are interested in the Doctor of Medical Science program at the Arizona School of Health Sciences, A.T. Still University. This allows us to hear from inspiring masters in the PA profession and those in healthcare who have really made a difference. A few housekeeping issues for our attendees. Please keep your microphones on mute. Please make comments in the chat session if you have any comments during the presentation. And once we're finished, we'll open it up to questions and you can unmute yourself. And Dr. Beth Popray, our administrative manager of the DMSC, will monitor the chat for any questions or comments. But before we get started, it's really an honor for me to take a minute to introduce our guest today, Mr. Ron Rosenberg, MPH, PA-C. Ron began his healthcare career as a U.S. Navy hospital corpsman in 1965. After discharge from the Navy, he entered the medics training program at the Dartmouth College Medical School and graduated in 72 as one of the very first PAs in the United States. Over the next 10 years, he practiced in a variety of clinical settings. We'll talk more about that, including rural primary care, academic cardiology, and family practice, and urban urgent care. While on the clinical staff of the University of Utah College of Medicine, Ron completed his Master's of Science in Public Health with a concentration in health services research. In 82, Ron left clinical practice and moved to the business side of medicine, first in developing and delivering health risk appraisals and health promotion programs, and then in developing and marketing market analysis reports using data files from the Healthcare Finance Administration. In 86, Ron began consulting in the management of medical practices and was a partner in Consulting Concepts, Inc., a practice management consulting firm. CCI evolved into a specialty firm concentrating in advising medical school faculty practices on reimbursement, compliance with HCFA's teaching physician guidelines, business operations, and managed care. In 92, Ron left CCI and founded the Practice Management Resource Group, the PMRG, a consulting firm providing practice management services to physicians' practices of all specialties and organizational structure, both private, academic, and institutional practice. PMRG has successfully completed various engagements, including reimbursement enhancement, practice financial performance assessments, practice valuations, managed care strategic planning and marketing, alliance formation, practice mergers, and managed care contracting, like in capitation. In 2002, PMRG developed an outsourced billing service, providing billing and receivables management services to small and medium-sized practices in ophthalmology and all of its subspecialties. So Ron has written book chapters on practice financial policies and fee schedules and physician compensation and managed care and articles on physician alliance development. He's also co-authored a book for the American Academy of Ophthalmology on capitation for medical surgical eye care. He recently completed a series of modules on financial management and performance for the American Academy of Ophthalmology. So Ron brings a huge blend of clinical background and practice management experiences to all of PMRG services. Their success is based on the premise that in the currently evolving managed care environment, that a blend of clinical and business skill is required for the success of any practice. So, and I could go on and on. I've known Ron for many years, but Ron, welcome to our master class today.
Thanks, Randy. I don't know whether to be really tired and weary listening to all that. I guess it's good that I've turned 80, so I can't remember a lot of it.
That's, hey, you know, I hear you. Well,
let me just say one more thing about it, and you'll see as I go through the things I want to talk about, that my point of view is that having a clinical background is so applicable and gives you such a leg up with anything you're going to do in healthcare. And that's what I've really based my businesses and my consulting on, being able to understand the clinical services being provided by the clients to be able to maximize or optimize their management and efficiency and effectiveness.
Yeah, you're right on target. Well, let's get right to it. Let's start from the beginning. You know, you started your career as a clinically practicing PA, and obviously in the very early days of the profession. So what drew you, first of all, to Dartmouth, and then what drew you to the PA profession? So, you know, tell us about those early clinical practices and what it's like to be in a new, really unknown profession.
Well, I'd really like to be able to say that when I was in high school in the 50s, 1950s, that I set my sights on being a PA and consulting with medical practices. That's not how my life worked. I started college at the University of Illinois in animal science. I was working with horses, teaching horseback riding and training jumpers and hunters. I moved to Southern California, started school all over again, and ultimately was going to get drafted. So I joined the Navy as a hospital corpsman. When I first started as a PA, met my first wife. We moved from Madison, Wisconsin to New England. And in the process of the move, this was in 1970, discovered that this whole thing about PAs, it was an article, I can't even remember what magazine it was in. It may have been in a Sunday magazine for a newspaper about this thing. And lo and behold, one of the programs that was just getting started was at Dartmouth, which was about 25 or 30 miles from where we lived in Vermont. So I applied to the program. I mean, I really loved the clinical work that I did in the Navy and applied to Dartmouth and was accepted into the first class, which started in January of 72. And that was the MedX model. So a certain amount of time at the medical school doing didactic training, a limited number of clinical rotations. It was really mostly classroom and then a year-long preceptorship with a primary care practice, a general practice in most cases, somewhere out in the community. And the community that I lived in, we lived in Corinth, Vermont, when I was at Dartmouth, and then moved to Colebrook, New Hampshire, which is right up on the Canadian border. And the way medicine was in those rural communities was that, you know, the doc would explain what a PA was. And basically, I think what the patient heard was almost like a cartoon in the Sunday comics. The doc said, yada, yada, yada. And what the patient heard was always working with Dr. Gifford. He must be all right. And so while up in northern New Hampshire, I got my first taste of health planning. I was assigned or appointed to the regional, I guess it was program review committee for the health. Gosh, I can't even remember what it was called back then. It was 50 some years ago, but it was part of the cost containment where they had a program review committee. Any program that was going to cost more than X dollars had to be reviewed by this committee and a project review committee. So any capital expenditure, like for a CT scanner or a new building, had to be approved by that committee. And so I drove, once a month to Burlington, Vermont. At the completion of the program, for various reasons, I did not stay with my preceptor in Colebrook, New Hampshire, but was recruited to join the Checkerboard Area Health System in Cuba, New Mexico. And I arrived there in 73 and, ran a satellite clinic. The main clinic was in Cuba. My satellite clinic was in Coyote. Three of the satellites were either on or adjacent to the Navajo reservation. My clinic was principally Hispanic, but we were a bit adjacent to the Hickory Apache reservation. So we had a mix of people. And it was really frontier medicine. We saw a mixture of just kind of sick call kinds of things, treating chronic diseases, trauma, We took call at the main clinic in Cuba. They sent me to Project Hope in Ganado, Arizona, to learn how to deliver babies. I can tell you that delivering babies in a fully staffed delivery room with OB nurses, et cetera, is very different than rolling an OB table out of a closet in the clinic and having the secretary assist you. But we had good backup from University of New Mexico, and I didn't lose any patients. I maybe delivered a dozen patients in that year, dozen babies in that year. Just as a quick aside, I don't know if those of you that practiced a lot clinically, and those of us in the early days where we had, one could say that our training was somewhat sketchy. The doc showed me how to do a pudendal block, and he showed me how to find the ischial spine. And there's Iowa trumpet, which is a needle guide about this long. And the first patient came in, and I mean, I was sweating bullets. The nurses thought I was going to pass out. And I put the trumpet in, and I injected xylocaine and did a digital block on my finger. And that was my introduction to delivering babies. So, we had a Navajo EMT who I thought had the potential to complete the PA program at Utah, and I also had a medical assistant who I thought was sharp enough to also complete the program. She was in my clinic in Coyote, a Hispanic woman. And so I contacted the program at Utah to see about getting them in, and they did a site visit down to our system. And lo and behold, they accepted both of those students into the program and offered me a job. And I think my wife and I were ready to leave Cuba, New Mexico. And so that's when we moved to Salt Lake, and I joined the staff of the Department of Family and Community Medicine. You know, Randy asked the question, how did I get to, or is that a later question, Randy, about into academics?
Well, actually, you're right on target. First of all, before I go on, I want to make sure that we thank you for your service with the U.S. Navy.
You're welcome.
You and I, as you know, I first met you when you taught at the University of Utah when I was a student there. And I'm going to talk about an anecdote in a minute. But yeah, so this is a good time to, you know, what led you to academia and also getting your MPH?
Yeah, well, I never really went into academia because the job I had at Utah, although it was more preceptoring students rather than teaching didactic lectures. Randy and the other students would come into the family practice clinic and they would shadow me. I worked at a national research project in hypertension, the Hypertension Detection and Follow-Up Program. And we had a clinic in Salt Lake. And so some of the students would come and shadow me there. But I was never in the academic strata. So I, you know, my advancement was not dependent on any degree. And quite frankly, I had a somewhat checkered academic career prior to going to Utah. And I, while I had a lot of college credits at three different colleges, no degree. And so when the department began to offer a Master of Science in Community Medicine, the coursework looked interesting to me. And it looked like there were things that were being taught that I could use in my career. So I entered the program, not for the purpose of getting a degree, but for the purpose of learning some things. And so the chairman of the department and the head of the program went to the graduate school office and got them to accept me as a non-matriculated student. I did a couple of courses. I did really well. Then they allowed me to matriculate. And I entered the program and did all the coursework, most of which I found really valuable throughout my career over the next 30 or 40 years. Let's see. What else did you ask me, Randy?
I think you hit that. I'm gonna share my little story now. So since we're here in Utah, so I was this this tall, skinny kid from Idaho, very shy, and
he really was skinny.
I was skinny, but nobody will believe that anymore. But anyway. So as you said, you know, each week we would go down and you would take one of the students in your hypertension clinic. And I went down there and you sent me into room to talk to a patient, and you sort of stood there and I was talking to the patient. And after I was done, you took me out, and actually, Ron, you won't remember this, but you actually grabbed me by my collar and you dragged me out into the hallway. And you said, listen, if you're going to see patients, you need to have an inside voice. You need to have a patient voice. You're talking too loud. And I thought, who the heck is this guy? You know, I was pissed. I said, what does he know? But the fact that how many years later, 48 years later, I remember this, made a huge difference, because how you talk to patients in the exam room is crucial. And you took the time to, you know, to take this young, you know, kid to do that. So thank you for that. It made a huge difference.
You're welcome.
Well, after Utah, and by the way, I didn't put this in our notes, but Ron and I actually started the Intermountain Association of Physician Assistants long before Utah and the state chapter started. So we started the Intermountain Association, and that was Utah and Idaho, and I think Colorado and
Nevada.
Yeah. And so we started for the first couple of years, a group of people who got together, and we created CME opportunities. And that went on for a couple of years. I don't remember, but I think you were the president and I was the vice president, something like that. And then each state started doing, you know, its own thing with when the Utah Academy started, and you and I had something to do with that. But that sort of takes me to the next step. And that is getting involved in the professional associations, not only the Utah Academy, but Ron, you were involved in the AAPA in its early days. And in fact, if I remember right, helped start the House of Delegates and then went on to be president of the Academy. So what led you down that road?
Well, again, it's kind of like I didn't start in high school in the 50s aiming towards becoming a PA and the owner and founder of a business. So we started the Intermountain Academy mainly because none of the states had enough PAs to really have an effective organization. And again, it was 50 years ago, so I don't have a clear recollection, but I suspect it had something to do with, because I worked at the university, I probably had a lot more schedule flexibility than any other members. And then my boss, the chairman of the department, Hillman Castle, was one of the kind of drivers of the Association of Physician Assistant Programs. So he really supported me in going to the meetings, the national meetings, and I was able to travel partially, at least on the university's dime. So that's how I got involved. That's how I ended up with leadership in the Intermountain Association. And then when I got to the AAPA, I mean, I remember the first meeting was at Shepherd Air Force Base in Texas, and met a lot of people. And there was a segment of the Academy up to that point, almost all of the leadership in the Academy were Duke graduates. And there may have been some exceptions, but they were interested in getting some new blood in. And so I was not a Duke graduate, and so I was welcomed into the leadership. I was on the Judicial Committee, and we started a House of Delegates modeled after the American Academy of Family Physicians. There were three of us on the Judicial Committee, and Gail Hirschbein, Bill Hughes, and I. And Bill was going to be the speaker. And I can't remember if it was before the meeting when we actually had our first House of Delegates meeting, but he had some personal issues come up and he dropped out. And so actually, I'm not sure if I was ever the speaker. I know I was vice speaker. And And from there, kind of moved into running for president. I was elected president. And for a lot of reasons, I thought that I could do the best job if I moved to Washington, D.C. And I relocated there and got a job at Group Health, running the minor injury unit in the evenings. And it was flexible. The other PAs working for Group Health would cover for me so I could travel and I could make a living, because at that time, I guess now there's a stipend for the president. They actually get paid for being president. It wasn't that way when I was president. And so that's how I got involved in PA leadership.
Yeah, and I remember in 79, you were president, and I was fortunate enough to be on your board at that time. And right. Just a lot of things going on in the late 70s, early 80s. But let's move on after that. After you got out of being president, you actually made a drastic change in your work by moving into the business side of medicine. So talk to us about that. I mean, the rest of your life has really been involved in the business side. So what led you there, and what's going on with that?
Well, when I moved to Washington, D.C. from Salt Lake, I fully intended to go back after my 3 years of president-elect president and immediate past president. And as these things happen, I met my current wife in 1980, and we got married in 1982. So I stayed in D.C. and moved over into the business side, started a company. I mean, I had a couple of different jobs on the business side of medicine, but along with three of the folks that I knew from the University of Utah, they were in the Department of Family and Community Medicine on the staff side, mostly in community medicine. We started a company that specialized in coding, CPT coding, and we led coding seminars all over the country back in 1980, the mid 80s. And the other thing that we did at that time, I don't know how familiar a lot of you are with Medicare reimbursement. You know, starting in 92, the resource-based relative value scale became the basis for Medicare allowables. But back then it was usual, customary, and reasonable. And Medicare would pay the lesser of what you charge, what you usually charge, and what is usually charged in the community. So for large practices, academic practices, large multi-specialty practices, they made a lot of extra money simply by knowing what obviously they knew what they charged, but so many of them were losing a lot of money because they were charging less than the customary and reasonable was in their community. And so we used Medicare databases to get that information, to find out what was being charged, and put together reports for practices, and then consulted with them on how to code properly for those services. So I did that until 1992, and we kind of fell into a specialty of working mostly with academic practices, which I really didn't like as much as office-based practices. And my partners wanted to merge. They were offered the opportunity to merge with CSC Healthcare to really concentrate on academic practices. And I didn't want to do that, so I left and formed my own company, PMRG, and I was doing consulting with practices, and kind of fell into a specialty of ophthalmology practices. Did a lot of work with the American Academy of Ophthalmology. And I'd always wanted to go into billing, but I knew enough about myself to know that what's required of somebody doing billing is almost a neurosis of being detail oriented. And I knew that wasn't me. So one of the jobs I had in consulting engagements was with a business unit of Rush Press St. Luke's in Chicago, which one of their business units reprocessed about 80% of all the facility Medicaid claims in the state of Illinois. And the woman that ran that business unit after that kind of for-profit entity ceased to be, called me and wanted to do something, and she'd be the perfect partner to have to start a billing service. And I, so we started investigating the development of that, and then brought a friend of mine in from the Bay Area who I had known for 10 years, who was a business guy, and he was going to run the business side of it. We were bootstrapped, so he was a master at, you know, finding money and keeping the company afloat till it became profitable. So that's how I got into the business of medicine, and I, you know, I really enjoyed it. Again, we had a specialty of ophthalmology, but one of the things that I really got to see in meeting with other people, the healthcare, I can't even remember what it's called, Healthcare Finance Administration, not HICFA, but, you know, hospital CFOs and those kinds of things, is that most people that consulted with medical practices really didn't understand in an up close and personal way the clinical services, and therefore they couldn't fully get to the coding and the fee setting, you know, knowing what's included in a certain CPT code, what services, what should be billed separately, and really gave us a leg up having that clinical background.
Yeah, and that's been your life in you know, the last couple of decades. I do want to, while we have the time, talk to you a little bit about some professional issues. You know, you've been a PA for 50 years or so, and as you know, I'm not far behind you. In 2017, the AAPA House of Delegates approved Optimal Team Performance, OTP. And, you know, what are your thoughts? This is a significant change in areas of PA practice since 2017, and lots of controversy about that, a lot of controversy between our relationship with physicians. I'd love to get your take on OTP.
Well, you know, you got to remember, I come from the horse and buggy days, where one of my main jobs as president of the academy was soothing over ruffled feathers in the relationships with the other professional organizations. And, you know, physicians were afraid, especially with their experience with nursing, that they were going to, you know, somebody was going to try and come and tell them how to practice. And I don't know, I understand the legislative issues and some of the other issues when I read the position paper on the AAPA's website. But for me, it shows up a little bit. I'm not sure. I need to be convinced that not having that really hinders the development of the profession. And I can see some places where it does. But, you know, I need to see it. And, you know, the anecdote that I like to give, I would love to get, at some point, I would love to get Dr. Emanuel, not Rahm Emanuel, but is it Jake? Is he the one that was involved in developing the meaningful use requirements for EMR? You know, I've been kind of contrarian in terms of EMR. I'd love to get him in a room and find out from him what has been the productivity penalty he's experienced from using an electronic medical record. And of course, there is none because he doesn't see patients. I'm not sure he ever has seen patients. And so I would want to know what I can see what the advantages would be, but I'd want to see what the downside is. And unfortunately, it may be that we're not going to be able to see that until it's too late, one way or the other. I unfortunately don't have to deal with that. One of the other things I've gained through being involved for 50 years with leadership is I no longer have to give a definitive and authoritative opinion on things. So I'm fine with it being, you know, however it is. I just think that there's a potential downside in terms of the reaction from from docs. And one of the things that I discovered, I don't think it's any great secret, that the people that run medicine, you know, the medical societies the kind of people who have the power to really object to something like the issues of that we're talking about, really don't see patients for a living. They're academic people that were this optimal team practice. It's kind of like Dr. Emmanuel and EMR. Yeah, it sounds good. And, you know, as I think all my health problems were kind of stored up and hit me on my 80th birthday. So I've been seeing a lot of doctors recently. And, you know, there's three or four big health systems in the Tucson area. Some of them are also in Phoenix. And they're all on different EMRs. And none of them talk to each other. And so I'm not sure that the gains from EMR are really appreciated or realized for all the time it takes docs. So anyway, I don't have a strong opinion on that.
Well, you know, Ron, this you'll understand this. Right now, the average age of PAs is right around 38 years of age. And so you and I actually represent about 8% of the profession. That's 8% of people who are over 65. So when we talk about OTP with my friends and colleagues, I say, hey, let me know how it goes. You know, it's something for the current profession. Now, and since we're talking about that, you know, what's your take on the title change, you know, physician associate, which is approved by the House and then ratified by the AAPA a number of years ago, passed the House. And obviously it's going to take years and years in each state to have that happen. But, you know, you and I started off as medics. We weren't even PAs. We were just corpsmen. That's right. What's your thought?
Pardon? My thought on that? Well, it sounds like a good idea. I'm not sure ultimately it makes much difference because people don't, you know, in practice, people don't refer to you as a physician assistant or a physician associate. They refer to you as a PA. And it's interesting that back to the last topic, in terms of acceptance of the optimal team practice, the people that will object to it are not the people in the trenches. You know, the docs who are seeing patients and have a PA on their team to provide care are not the ones that are going to put up a stink about it. And it's the same thing with physician assistant versus physician associate. And again, when you take those things together, physician associate, the connotation that some in organized medicine may take is that the connotation is that it's someone equal on the team, and it's nice to say and be a purist to say it's not a hierarchy. Basically, it is. You know, I mean, it's the medical assistant and the pharmacist and everybody else is on the team, and sometimes the physician, who is the kind of the thought leader in terms of clinical knowledge, may not be the ideal leader of the team, but at some point there may be some pushback from physician associate, from optimal team practice.
Yeah, well, that's great. So I'm gonna start to land this airplane. So Ron, you know, you and I have talked earlier about people in our Doctor of Medical Science program. You know, what would be your advice to our doctoral students about their future, as well as about their future as graduates from, you know, from the into the PA profession?
Well, I the thing that I would let people know, and by the way, when I got my MPH, they changed the program from a Master of Science in Community Medicine to an MPH because I had never done the thesis, and I ran into the director of the program 15 years later when I was actually doing a project at the University of Utah. And he said, when are you going to get your degree? And I said, Charles, I'm not going to do a thesis. I just don't have the time. And he said, no, we changed the program. You'll be fine. You know, you just have to come in for a weekend and do a committee. Meanwhile, between that time and the time I did the committee, I turned in the report, which was on the department, the clinical side of the department and reimbursement. And he said to me, well, that would have been your thesis. So, but what I did with my degree, I have it back now because my mother passed away 10 years ago. I sent it, as soon as I got it, I sent it to my mother because she had always been upset that I didn't have a college degree. The thing that I would say to prospective students is you really need to ask yourself the question, why do I want to get a PhD? Now, to me, it's kind of asked and answered if you're in academics and you want a career in academics, because as far as I understand, you're not going anywhere unless you have a PhD. I assume that's correct. But if you're not going to be in academics, then the question is, why do you want to do the program? I did the Master of Science in Community Medicine or MPH program for the coursework, you know, research study design, epidemiology, biostatistics, field evaluation. I can't remember the names of all the courses, but each and every one of them was valuable in terms of my career. And because of my particular career, the degree itself, other than to make my Jewish mother happy, was not that important. So you really need to look to see, again, how many, Brandy, what's your sense of how many of your students are not going into academics program faculty?
Well, that's a good question. And I think as the biggest track we have, and Beth can correct me, but the biggest track we have is education, the education track. And this is for folks who are either in education or want to move from clinical practice into education. The second track that seems to be the largest in is our leadership track. Again, that's for folks who want to move into some sort of a leadership role, the C-suites or clinic management, those kind of things. And then it sort of goes down from there. Am I accurate, Beth, on that?
Yes, you are. We kind of have a different dichotomy. The education track is we have some that are young faculty who just started and wanting to excel in the profession, or they want to get into academia to start with. And then we have some in the leadership track that are current faculty and they just want to improve on their leadership skills going forward. I'd say probably since we've graduated, the two classes, maybe about 5% have gone on and pursued careers in academia.
Yeah.
5%?
Yeah. Yeah. There's probably more that would like to.
Okay. Yeah. Again, I just think for anybody that is contemplating getting a PhD, and not just your program, but any program, what's in it for you? I mean, in terms of your career, and again, if you want to be in academics, it's kind of a ticket in. But for anybody else, you really need to look at the course content, and given what you want to do with your career, is that something that's going to further your professional development?
Excellent. I'm going to probably give us some time now for questions, but I have the first question for you, Ron. So with your busy schedule still, tell us more about what you do for fun. I remember you used to do a lot of flying, but what do you do for fun? What do you do for fun now?
Well, you know, we have a dog. My wife, you know, we've been married 40 years. We've been together 42 years. And she worked as a management consultant and traveled internationally. And I traveled almost every week around the U.S. in my work. So to some degree, are enjoying being home. We never could have a dog because of our traveling. So we got a dog. We used to do hiking, or we still do a little. I gave up my plane about 10 years ago, and I actually was thinking of getting into flying again. And I had an evaluation by a neurologist and, got diagnosed with a meningioma, which 99% of them are benign in my brain. And I've had some side effects from that, but basically flying's just gotten a lot more expensive since I stopped. Fuel has probably gone a factor of five at least, and everything's more expensive. So my life is fine without it. We had all kinds of trips planned when COVID hit. And so those all got canceled. And so we'll start traveling again. My wife went to Panama for a course over the Christmas holidays, and I have a cousin that retired there. So we'll probably go down and visit them in the spring. You know, I mean, Tucson, we love Tucson. It's a whole different flavor from Phoenix. It's much more laid back. We think it's prettier, but so we're enjoying life. And fortunately, I was able to build a company. That was really our gamble. I was able to build a company and sell my share of it. We're not wealthy. I'm not going to go out and buy a Learjet, but you know, we have a house and life is good.
Well, that's great. I have to ask, and this is for Beth, what kind of dog do you have?
Pitbull.
All right.
100% Staffordshire, American Staffordshire Bull Terrier.
Very good. Well, I'm going to open it up to questions. And Beth, is there anybody on the chat that had some questions?
Well, we don't have any yet, I believe. And Doug had a question earlier, but I think Ron answered that for him. So we'll open it up.
Yes. So if you have a question, go ahead and unmute and jump right in. I'm surprised that nobody's jumping in because
I'm always happy to break the ice. So I'm the non-PA in the group. So I'm curious, Ron. So what kind of was your premise, your passion behind, you know what, I'm going to go into business. So it seems like that's a very specific group of people in healthcare that make that leap onto the business side.
Well, a couple things. First of all, the area of business that I went into is not your typical business. I mean, it was really a support function, outsourcing some management services for medical practices. It's not like we do. And I consult with people on alliance development and how to avoid the pitfalls of private equity, those kinds of things. But I really enjoyed clinical practice, but it to some degree limited me, not necessarily just financially, but in terms of flexibility, travel, those kinds of things. And again, I would love to say that I sat down with Karen, my wife, and we looked at all the pros and cons and, you know, did a strategic and tactical analysis before deciding. No, it was an opportunity came up and, okay, what am I going to have to give up to leave clinical practice? And what am I going to get by going into the business side of things? And that's how that decision was made.
Great. Other questions?
Hey, Ron, this is Caitlin Jarvis. I really enjoyed your talk, and we live outside Washington, D.C. right now. And I was just wondering kind of what's the best way to kind of get your feet wet and get involved with AAPA? It's something I've been wanting to do, and I just, you know, haven't really, you know, gotten started there. So I'm just would be really curious kind of how you got started and got involved.
I suspect it's a little different now only because when I got involved, you know, it was a fledgling organization. When I graduated from PA school, there were 125 graduates. So, but what I would do is, where do you live? Just out of curiosity.
We live right outside of Bethesda, Maryland. We live in Rockville, Maryland. So it's probably like 30 minutes from DC.
And no, when I moved to DC, I first moved to Virginia, and then I met my current wife, and she's a native of D.C., but always lived on the Maryland side. So we lived in Rockville, Princeton,
oh, nice.
Et cetera. Yeah. So what I would do is, and anybody that's currently active with the Academy, correct me if I'm wrong, but I would go on with the, generally the first thing you want to do is get involved with the Maryland Academy. And there are, I know a lot of PA leaders, the fellow that did the December program is a past president of the Academy and is in Maryland. So I would contact the Maryland Academy and find out about opportunities to be on committees, to do volunteer work. It's all volunteer work, but get involved at the state level and find out the lay of the land. Can you be, you know, do you want to try and be a delegate to the House of Delegates? If there's a particular area of interest that you have, I don't know what your professional background is outside of just plain clinical, but there may be committees at the state level or at the AAPA that you could volunteer for that would get you involved.
Awesome. Great. Thank you. Just, you know, we just moved to the area, so just trying to get established and see where we can start.
Where did you move from?
We moved from the country of Bahrain.
Oh, got it.
So yeah, in the military. So we move a lot, but okay. Kind of getting towards the end of the year. So hopefully, you know, we might be here long-term. So trying to figure out how to get involved. And since we're so close to Washington, D.C., it's, you know, a great place to kind of get involved. Yeah, so yeah, thank you.
You're welcome.
You know, I might add, and I was talking to Ron earlier about this, back in the day, in the 70s, when the Academy, as Ron says, was sort of fledgling, and we had a public education committee chairman who actually resigned, and I had sent a letter to the president saying, this is terrible, you know, to have the public education committee chairman resign. We need public education in this country about PAs. And he sent me a letter and said, great, would you like to be the new chair? So you have to be careful what you ask for.
Yeah.
You know? But that's how I started. And it's about, you know, having some passion about something. And Ron, you know, as well as I do, in the early days, we had no clue where the profession was going to go, except we knew we were part of it and had to sort of, you know, step up to the plate. And now with 150,000 plus PAs out there, I have to say, I wish that the majority of those PAs had the passion for the profession that many of the people in the 70s and 80s did. But it's not, I don't think it's true, especially with the, and I don't mean to publicize this, but, you know, I mean, the numbers of members of the AAPA, you know, was still about a third of the PAs in the country. And that's sort of sad, you know, it's the old story of, you know, I'd rather be inside the profession making things happen. So,
right.
Yeah. Other questions or comments?
One thing, Randy, or anyone else who's based in Arizona, Randy told me that the Arizona Academy, is it the annual meeting?
The state association is having their CME there in Tucson next month.
Is it just CME?
Yes.
Got it. Okay.
All right. Anything else?
Can I just say one thing to Ron, as well as to Randy and Bert, to make sure everybody understands that just because my hair is the same color as theirs, I'm way younger than they are. And I chose not to get into PA politics, and I've always regretted that. So I really want to thank the three of you for all you've done for this profession. You know, thank you for your service in Vietnam, but thank you for your service to the PA profession also. I have definitely benefited from your service for more than 30 years now. I can't say 50 like Randy can. I'm getting close. I love coming to these because I really feel just so fortunate to have the opportunity to work with people like you all, the three of you. So thank you again.
Oh, you're welcome.
And thank you, Bert.
If any of you get down to Tucson, give me a jingle. Randy, is my contact information available to folks?
Excellent. Well, I'm gonna wrap this up, Ron. But any last words before I actually land the airplane?
No. I'd love Randy to stay in contact with you to learn more about the career paths of your graduates. And and I assume Beth and Randy, you have contact with the other PhD programs that are similar or along the same lines as yours, to start to build some data on what the graduates are doing.
Yeah, absolutely. And thanks for bringing it up. We have about, I think, 10, 11 now DMSC programs out there that are PA specific, and we have a good relationship with them. And we continue to talk about, I mean, you know, a success for any program is a success for all of the programs and a success for the profession. So yeah, thanks for bringing that up. So, okay. Well, Ron, thanks for your time today, participating in our masterclass. And thanks to all of you for being here. Please mark your calendar for our next masterclass. It's going to be on February 21st. It's going to be with Dave Mittman, who also a past president of AAPA. Quite an entrepreneur, quite a story. And I'm hoping to see you all there. So the best to all of you. And once again, Ron, thanks for your time.
You're welcome. Thanks, all of you.